Yes, this is the Mark Haney Show, and today we are going to learn a little bit about success. What makes somebody into an extremely successful founder? Today, I am privileged to be sharing the story of Aaron Klein. He is the co-founder and CEO of Riskalyze. Riskalyze has recently raised a huge chunk of money to help skyrocket their business. They're already a national company. And they're in the tech side of things, in helping investors to understand their risk portfolio. But this story is less about the product and more about how to build a company and actually have success in raising that capital. So it's going to be very educational, inspirational, and I think you're going to get a lot out of it. So stick around and hear the story of Aaron Klein. And now I am here with Aaron Klein. He is the founder of Riskalyze. And I got to say, how are you doing? I mean, you were in the news, what, a month or two ago, and I talked to you. And
that's right.
Why were you in the news? Why you're always in the newspaper. You're always this time it's the Business Journal. You're always making the news.
Well,
what was this latest one?
Yeah, the latest one was pretty great. We started Riskalyze in 2011, and it has been an incredible journey for the first decade. And you know, it was interesting. I'll tell you, when we got into the beginning of 2020, some of our early angel investors were kind of like, Aaron, you know, it's been 9 amazing years. It's very clear the company's doing really well. Okay. I was 75 years old when we invested, you know, like now I'm like 84, 85, pushing 85.
You took on some old elderly investors.
Right, that's right. They're like, when do I get to spend some of this money that we've made? Right. Yeah. And that was a very fair question. I feel such an enormous gratitude to the folks who entrusted us with their capital, you know, and placed their trust in us. And so, I thought that was really fair. And we started thinking about trying to get some liquidity for them. And then the pandemic hits, right. Mm. And, you know, we went through a roller coaster year in 2020. I mean, we work with financial advisors. The markets are down 30%, right?
Yeah.
Financial advisors are paid on a percentage of the assets that they oversee.
Yeah, at the beginning of COVID, I'm thinking of like March 2020, 33 days
peak to trough, right? And like late February to middle of March. And so early March, you're looking at it, you're like, holy cow. Like our customers, their revenue is down somewhere between 15-20%. How many of them can handle that? How many of them will go out of business? We're modeling like, what if 30% of our customers go out of business?
Right.
You know, that's not a particularly great thing to model, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we just didn't really know. We hadn't, you know, if you think about it, we were started in 2011. The market had not been through a massive shock. We'd had some points of volatility, but we hadn't really gone through a massive shock. And so we're sitting there going, we'd like to think that we're like a must-have solution, but what if we're a nice-to-have solution, right?
And you're going to find out, right?
Yeah, we're about to find out. Exactly right. And so, you know, to make matters worse, we had embarked on like a really aggressive growth plan for the beginning of the year. And we had been profitable the year before, but like we had done a ton of hiring and we had hired ourselves into unprofitability because we were investing,
right,
you know, capital we had in the bank to do that. Well, you know, now all of a sudden I'm looking like in the early days of March and, you know, middle March, somewhere around there. And you know, the growth machine has just kind of like ground to a halt. Like knock on wood, we ended up not going a single business day without adding at least one advisor.
One new customer.
Okay. But we were used to adding a lot more than that.
Yeah.
And so it was like, you could feel the machinery just kind of grinding to a halt. And so, you know, I'm looking at that and we're modeling this and going, oh my gosh, like if 30% of our customers go into business, we have this gaping hole where we're paying all these new people. And my board is telling me, lay people off, Like you've got to lay people off right away. Like you need to move very quickly.
Well, a lot of us older guys, we remember 2008 and it didn't come back and really quickly.
No, it took a year and a half.
Yeah.
Right. And so they're like, we don't make it to a year and a half. Like, you know, so like you have to go lay people off. we were modeling this, looking at it. Then like the Imperial College study hit, which was out of London, that basically said, you know, there's no vaccine on the horizon. Even if we do everything well with lockdowns and social distancing and all these different things, like 2 million Americans are going to die. Turned out, by the way, that the sourcing and the data for the model of that study was awful. Like it was 6 plane loads of Americans coming out of Wuhan, China. And like the methodology was really bad. But nonetheless, we don't know that in that time. We're looking at this and it's telling us that, and my CFO was like, I mean, this could put banks into bankruptcy, right? Like our credit line could get pulled. We literally called the bank that day and like pulled the entire credit line and just put it in the bank, just trying to ensure liquidity.
Oh, right.
Pulled the revolver, like put it in the bank. So that was when, you know, we did a PPP loan, mm-hmm. you know, and the PPP loan is what allowed me to kind of tell my board, hey, we're not laying people off. Like, that came in and
well, it's interesting because the PPP loan, this is my recollection, is we didn't find out about the PPP loans like the first week that stuff hit the fan.
It
took a little while. The PPP was obviously incentivizing us to keep our employees.
Well, that's what I told my board.
But before that came out, there wasn't any incentive.
No, you're sitting there looking at this and going, I'm going to solve this alone, right?
Yes. You know?
And so when that came out and it looked good that we were going to get it done, I just told my board, I'm like, look, we get this PPP loan, we're not laying off a single person this year, okay? Because it is unemployment being paid through companies. Like, that's what it is.
Right.
You know? And so so nonetheless, we you know, that happened. You know, I was able to tell the team, hey, look, like we got to figure out our path back to growth here, but like we're not going to do layoffs this year. If we can't get, you know, our path back to growth, we're going to have to make some very hard decisions at the end of this year. But like, you know, at this point, like we've got some runway and we're going to do that. So my board agreed with me on that and we went to work and, you know, turned out our Q4, it turned out like 104% of our original plan for Q4. Okay.
Wow.
We didn't make plan for the whole year, but like we had a great Q4, kind of came back and rocketed back. And ended up having
rally
a good year.
I mean, did they big feel
time.
Like, you know what, we have to do this.
Big
we,
time.
We were kept on for a reason. Let's make this, let's,
big
let's
time.
Prove ourselves.
Big time. And I mean, it took every single person in the company just stepping up and pushing hard and going, we're going to do our part to make that growth story come together. So I could not be more proud of that team or grateful for that team.
So it ended up being a great Q4.
It ended up being a great Q4. And so we go into 2021 and, you know, and we're like, okay, we need to, you know, now those angel investors are 85, you know, they're fully 85, right?
Getting younger.
It's time. And so we started some conversations there and, you know, it was very interesting. We started working on it. It was probably April, that we really started working in earnest on it. And it was very interesting for me, Mark, because so first of all, I've never owned anywhere close to a majority of the company, right? I was a co-founder, but we had other co-founders, plus we had the early money that came into the company. I wasn't financially able to just start it myself. And we had some IP that came into the company and that ate up some points as well.
Okay.
So at the end of the day, like I didn't...
Intellectual property.
Yeah. So I never owned, you know, a majority of the company from day one. And I've always been very comfortable with that. I've recruited an independent board, you know, and I've worked at the pleasure, you know, of the board, but worked really well with a board. And I've always been very comfortable with that. But, you know, it was tough for me because we're starting those conversations and I'm kind of realizing like, this could be it, you know, like I have to take my CEO hat off and put my board member hat on and act like a fiduciary for all of my shareholders. Mm-hmm. And it's very possible that like what pops out of this process is, you know, a strategic transaction that, you know, that one of these strategic 800-pound gorillas, you know, big corporation is willing to like really pay up and buy us. And, you know, and you know, I'm feeling like I'm in the third inning of a baseball game, right?
Okay.
And I think we've got more to build. I think we've got more to do.
So let me make sure I slow this down for myself here and maybe the audience. So you need some liquidity for some of your early investors.
Yep.
Board gets together and says, how are we going to make this happen? happened, and you decided to run some kind of process that allowed you to get that liquidity.
Well, the other thing that was clear is that, you know, FTV Capital, who'd invested in Riskalyze in 2016, is coming up on 5 years. Mm. So they were thrilled. They were like, hey, we'll stay 7, we'll stay 8, but they're going to have to book a return for their fund. Do I want to do this again in another year or two? So now we're talking about a majority of the company that we have to kind of like find liquidity for.
Okay.
Right? Majority of the shareholder base. So it was just clear to me that we were having, you know, we're having some discussions. We didn't go out and run like a formal process. We handpicked like some of the strategics that we thought there might be a really good fit, had some conversations. To be clear, like they've been in touch with us for years, right? Mm-hmm. We've had all kinds of these kinds of companies kind of swirling around and saying like, if you ever sell this thing, mm-hmm. like we want to be a part of the conversation. So I appreciate that. It's very flattering, but you know, we just thought that we had a lot more to add, but you know, look, maybe we're doing that as a part of a big strategic, and you know, you never know how that's going to go. That feels like a total roll of the dice, right? You might love it and you might just not really love it. And the ones who don't love it leave after 2 years after their, you know, contract is up and they're off to starting something else. And I really had the sense, I'm like, I feel like this is the third inning of a baseball game. And so it was, you know, what was fascinating is that we had a lot of interest from a lot of different places, but the firm that we partnered with, private equity firm, you know, one of the premier software and services investors in Europe, they're headquartered in London. Their tagline is, you know, we help, you know, businesses reinvent how they do business. That's the companies that they invest in, right? And I just was so like, they just came in, they had a huge alignment with our vision. They had incredible alignment. They loved like our market, our customers, the vision that we had for serving them. They had a lot of vision about what we could do together to kind of grow the impact on, you know, call it the wealth management industry, the wealth tech industry. And just like really great people, really great alignment with the people. And they just came in and were very aggressive and said like, you've built a premium business and we're willing to value it in a premium way.
Yeah, and the Business Journal listed a pretty big number, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars of valuation.
It was not disclosed, and so I can't speak directly
okay,
to that.
Okay, no comment.
No comment on that. But suffice it to say, it was a strong valuation. And
yeah.
we were really grateful for that. I think it was a fair valuation. And you know, I'm pretty sure, by the way, it was 2 weeks after we closed that they came to our annual conference and got to like be there. We actually got to pull it off this year. Got to be there with 800 of our best customers, you know, and I do think that they walked away from the conference going, I think we underpaid, which is good. That's a good feeling. I want them to have, right?
What did your early investors were they walking around with big smiles on their face?
They were walking around with big smiles. So I mean, the people who invested like day one did 50x their money.
Oh, I was
so excited about that.
Yeah.
And you know, across the board, you know, I think our most recent angel investor had made like 7x their money. FTV Capital made 4x plus on their money they invested in 2016. So just incredibly grateful to be able to deliver that kind of outcome. And then again, I just pinch myself because like I get to stay in a job I love, working with the team I love, on behalf of the advisors that we love to serve. And that is like I am the luckiest guy in the world because I'm in the third inning of the baseball game. We're turning the page. We're opening the fourth inning, and I've got this incredible capital partner, and we're going to go do some really great things in the marketplace over the next 5 years.
Well, it sounds like they invested in you. So sometimes private equity might come in and buy, or a strategic comes in and buys a company, and you know the CEO is not needed long term.
Yes.
So they're investing in you to grow the company.
They invested in our team and our vision. You know, and I think that's right. And I think that they said, you know, this is new for me, like working with a, you know, an investor at this scale. They manage $37 billion in their family of funds, right? But, you know, they very much approached it like a partnership, and we each bring different things to the table, and it's a very complementary partnership. And I just could not be more excited about the next decade. The other thing that I love about them and their model is that they have, you know, we'll see how it plays out, but like they have portfolio companies that they have worked with for 15, 17 years because they will invest cross fund. So they can invest in successive funds.
And people that might be listening, typically what I've seen and, you know, been around this a little bit is these funds last for somewhere around 10 years. And so an investor comes in. They come in with the 5-year hold.
Yes.
Yeah. Is there a couple
and
years?
They need to book a return for the fund.
So they need to, they need to sell the company or have some sort of exit so they can get their money back out and pay their shareholders. So the fact that they're staying with companies that length of time and they have a way of doing that.
Yes.
That's attractive.
It's unique. And it was very attractive because we like to think very long term. It's been how we've thought for the first decade. And they like to think very long term. And I love that. And, you know, if our first couple of months of partnership or anything like our next decade of partnership is going to be, then we'll be together for a long, long time.
That's outstanding.
Yeah.
Did you use an investment banker?
Yeah, we did.
Okay.
And that was invaluable. We worked with a firm called Financial Technology Partners. We'd actually worked with them for a long time, just as a kind of a strategic advisor, financial advisor to the company. And you know, they did a lot of very helpful work. One of the things that they did is basically allowed us to pull that off without putting a massive amount of pressure on our own finance team. You know, one of the things I did is I kind of walled this off from most of my leadership team. And I was like, look, I'm going to pull a few of you in here at the, you know, at the end of the process to, because you're going to need to talk with the new investors and they're going to need to have some questions. But like, I didn't have to like shut down our finance team from doing their core day-to-day work to say, I need you to build decks and I need you to build the story. We had an investment banking team that was able to do a lot of that work.
That's great. Well, your books, you know, they're in order already when you go into these kind of processes. I mean, otherwise you don't get this kind
otherwise
of valuation.
You don't do it. That's right.
Yeah. But what about you? So sometimes the CEO, I would say quite often, the CEO, when they go through these processes is derailed in some way from the day-to-day operation. So how did you feel like it affected you personally? Super stressful?
Yeah. I mean, I process stress fairly well. And that's, I guess, one of the good things that's true about me, since that's inherent to the job, right?
God, I wish I had that.
There are times that I probably processed it better than others. But I didn't feel an inordinate amount of stress. I absolutely felt a sense of like, you know, for the first, so I would say, you know, April to call it July was more of the exploratory phase. Like we're having like conversations. We're not, you know, going super deep. It was very repetitive work, right? So it's like we're doing Zoom meetings with, you know, these different folks, and we're just taking them through a high level of business. Let's give, you know, they're under NDA. We're taking them through, you know, what we've done, what we've accomplished.
You know, it makes me think it's almost a blessing. You know, there's blessings that came out of COVID. One is we all got used to using Zoom.
Yes.
And so when you talk about a roadshow that you might go on to sell a company or to get financing or what have you, you know, you can shop around the world from the comfort of your office.
That became a little bit easier. That became a little bit easier. That's right. So I didn't. Now, I would say this. There was no way on earth that I was going to actually complete the transaction over Zoom.
Okay.
Right? You gotta know your partners and you gotta be able to look them in the eye. And that was still challenging because, you know, part of our, so the firm that we work with, HG, is headquartered in London and New York, and the London people could not enter the country. So I'm gonna meet our London partners soon, which I'm very excited about. I know them well over Zoom, but like, you know, I there were face-to-face meetings with the New York, you know, based partner and just, you know, spent a lot of quality time there making sure that these were the people that we wanted to work with, you know. But from like July to we announced August 25th, that was a very intense period of time. It was all consuming. And it was tough because, you know, I was very committed to making sure that the business didn't slip, that, you know, but the reality was that, you know, 80% of my time allocation was going into that work, you know? And so that's, you know, fortunately I have a very, very good leadership team, and I said, I'm going to wall you off from some of this. I'll give you quick updates every Monday morning, but like, we're not going to spend our Monday meetings talking about that. because that is not what is value creating about our business.
Right. We got to keep this thing rolling.
The advisors that we serve are where we create value in the business. So that's what we're going to talk
about. Were they looking like they, you know, they're going to do due diligence, they're going to track your progress, and you want to continue to show, you know, good sales and growth and so on, I'm sure. Were they checking the numbers like up to the day? Were they like watching you like a hawk up until the day it closed?
I mean, so
looking for a reason to.
No, it didn't feel that like that at all. I mean, first of all, one of the things that, you know, every one of them, a little bit of inside baseball with these, right? That I know you've been through this before, but like every one of them, you know, started talking as soon as they got kind of serious in the discussion, started talking about exclusivity. And I'm like, look, like we're not there yet. Like we're in the dating phase. Okay.
Right. And so this is, for listeners, this is before, you decide to take on the investment. They want an exclusive right to negotiate with you. Before that, it's almost like an auction. You've got several, people interested in you, and everybody wants to go exclusive.
You're everybody wants to go exclusive, and you're, you know, you're sitting there. We weren't really running an auction as much as I would say that we were holding court in the bar, right?
Okay.
You know, and so we were talking to a lot of different people, just seeing like, you know, where the real interest was, and you know, and HG was the first like to running hard.
Okay.
And I said like I'm very intrigued about doing this together, but before we can even talk about that, like you have to have complete conviction that you want to do this deal, that we are the right partner for you, that you love our business, that you want to be invested in this business. When we get to the point that you have total conviction on that, you've done your work, you've done your diligence, and you're like, I don't have caveats on this. Like, I want to do this deal. Then we can, you know, consider something like exclusivity, and we can, you know, give you a period. And part of exclusivity is about like, they're going to spend some real money. Okay.
Yeah. Like, after they do an LOI, after they make the offer though.
Yeah. So they've thrown like an initial indication down and said, we think we could be in this territory, but it's not real until they're like, we're getting to that, like we're going to go exclusive and they're going to spend a couple $1 million on due diligence, right? On consultants, on, you know, financial tax advisors, legal advisors, all those things. And so they spent some substantial money before we got to
that
point. At that
point, nobody wants to back out once everybody's spent all
this
money.
So we got to that on like our board met and made the decision to move forward with HG on August 4th. So that's me calling a number of other people who were very interested in doing something, who were a little bit further behind the curve, and just telling them our board decided to go in a different direction.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so a little bit of risk on our side there, because, you know, now if this doesn't go forward, I got to go back and wake those back up, and they go, well, what went wrong? What happened? You know, but we were really confident.
It's a little bit like, so for anybody listening, it's a little bit like selling a house, right? You got these offers in and you take one, or you get these interested parties.
If you fall out of escrow, people are like, what is wrong with the house?
What's wrong? Yes,
right?
Absolutely.
And so, and sometimes it's that your buyer had an internal political problem, you know,
exactly.
And that's the issue. So in any case, you know, we were really confident in the quality of the business. We were very confident in their quality as a partner too. And so we felt really good about doing that. We worked really hard for the next 3 weeks and got to a signed deal on August 24th. And we signed it at 9 o'clock at night on August 24th. The press release was all queued up, ready to go. And I mean, it went out the morning of August 25th and we announced.
And what was the first thing? So let's call it the funds hit the account. What's the reaction? Did you have a toast with your wife your family, man?
So, you know, when you sign August 24th, you're in a binding deal, but now you're in a binding deal, but it still has to close. There's a bunch of work you have to do before you close, right? So no money exchanges hands that night, right?
Gotcha. You put out the press release before that time.
Because it is binding. Like, there's a certain set of things that have to happen for the deal to actually close, but it's binding, you know, unless you have what they call a material adverse event, like the deal's going to close.
Okay.
And we were confident in the business. We know that we're not going to have a material adverse event. So we were confident it was going to close. So we, You know, my wife and I were out to dinner that night. It was kind of funny because she's like, well, we don't have time to go out to dinner tomorrow night. We got this, this, and this. She goes, let's go out to dinner time. I'm like, but it's not signed until like later. They're still working on all these last things.
And it's it's only 99.9% right? chance.
And she's like, no, we're doing it. So like we went out and like toasted each other. I'm like, well, we're not telling anybody that we toasted this deal until it's signed later tonight.
Bad luck, right?
Bad luck, right? But no, it was good. And by the way, the other thing I'll just share quickly is the signing process for these things is surreal. So we had signed all the documents that morning. Okay. Not the full documents, just the signature pages. You want to talk about trust? Try sending signed signature pages to your lawyer, okay, who then holds them in escrow while they finish working out the final versions of the documents.
Oh gosh. Okay. Yeah.
And so then it was literally like last like things, and they're like, I get a text, and my wife is like shopping in a store, like we're like walking through a store together. And I get a text, it's like, okay, we're ready for the signing call. Okay. And the signing call, like we go out to the car and we dial, you know, I dial into the call, and basically they're like, okay, we've got all the final, everything's in order. The lawyers are kind of like, we stipulate that the final versions of the documents are all in order. Everything's, you know, as everybody has agreed. We're like, okay. They're like, so do we have your authorization to release your signature pages? Yes, you do.
Yeah.
Great. We're signed. You know, it's like we signed that morning, but they released the pages that night. So that was,
it's like a climactic
moment. Anticlimactic.
Oh yeah.
Because like my wife took a video of the call because it's so hysterical. It's a 30-second call, and that's like the process of signing, you know, per se. So it's it was surreal.
And I don't think that's atypical, but they're all a little bit different. But that's super interesting. I think it's educational too. I think people listening that are thinking that they might be in this position one day, or they hope to be, you know, it's kind of educational. Who do you talk to about this stuff?
That's right.
It's not like you're. You know,
nobody told me what to expect. I'm assuming that I'm going to have a really nice pen that I bought or something, right? And I'm going to sign with that really nice pen. Nope. We DocuSigned everything that morning, and then they like released the pages. So then it was September 24th that we closed. So it was about a month later. And, you know, there was a lot of work to be done to get everything in order, get shareholders to sign off and approve the deal. You know, everybody was thrilled with the deal, but it's just work that has to happen, you know? And we got all that work done and satisfied all the conditions. And then the deal closed on the 24th.
That's so exciting. Anything you would do differently, or any like educational things that you can think of?
Well, I would just have HG call me like back in April and say, let's just do this. Let's sign today. And it's done. Yeah. But that's not how the process works.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly.
So I mean, look, I think that at the end of the day, what really served us well was to make sure that we were staying very focused on our values. Right. And we have these 9 core values at Riskalyze. And maybe that's like primary on my mind, because I just literally taught mission and values training this morning to a big new group of people who are joining the company. But, you know, our 9 core values keep us very focused on how we operate as a team and how we stay focused on the customers that we serve. Right.
How do you remember 9 core values? Now, our core values, they starts with commitments, but it spells out character. Right. So it's an acronym.
I like it.
So we ended, because how you can remember that many?
We're not that smart. we have.
Wasn't it was my idea, but I wasn't able to spell character, so I had some help on the spelling.
No, we're not that smart. So we have these 9 core values. I probably could name them all. I won't name them all off, but like you can go to riskalyze.com/values and read them. So that's my trick, is that I can just pull them up on my smartphone. But you know, like our value of delight talks about how we're just relentless at engineering moments of delight for our customers. We're customer obsessed. You know, our values around communication, we're an open, direct communication culture. Mm-hmm. Our values around teamwork. Teamwork, by the way, used to be one of our mushiest values, but we kind of rewrote it in 2020. It's now one of our most hardcore values. Like, we reject people who have like victim mentality. Like, this is what was true about our culture.
And
it wasn't just what we wanted to be.
Did your employees come up with that stuff? Or, I mean, leadership team?
Our team did a lot of input into this, but like, we basically are talking about like, we our culture like does organ rejection on people who have a victim mentality, who are mercenaries, who don't care about our mission, who, you know, are narcissists, who think it's all about them, who are jerks, who tear down others. Like, that's the 4 types of people that our culture just rejects. And, you know, it's interesting, because one time I remember hiring a relatively senior person who was 3 out of 4 people, as it turned out, like literally 3 of the 4 things. And, you know, you correct those mistakes when you make them, but they just don't work in our culture. So we call them out now. We say, I told the team this morning, I'm like, look, there are organizations designed for people who hate their jobs. Go to the DMV. You can find a bunch of people yeah, who hate what they do.
They intentionally make it that way, right?
Right.
For and all so, of
like,
us.
Like there are if you just hate to work and you hate what you do, there are organizations designed for you to still be able to make money and put food on the table. Okay. Yeah. We're not that organization. Like we're almost 200 people that absolutely love what they do and are passionate about making a difference for the financial advisors that we serve and ultimately for you know empowering our world to invest fearlessly. And so like that's what we do and we love doing it.
Okay, so you now have this access to more capital to really skyrocket the growth for the company. You'd already grown like crazy, but now you can keep it rolling.
Yep.
But you're doing it in Auburn.
So yes.
Do people ever say, "Hey, you can't make a tech company into a rocket ship in Sacramento or especially Auburn"? My God, you guys are out in the sticks.
Yes.
I mean, you get accused of like.
So people would say all the time, "Why in God's name did you start the company in Auburn?" And I said, "Because I lived there." You know, like
it's a nice town. I love Auburn. Yeah.
The truthful answer was, I knew we were going to hire a lot of people from Sacramento and Roseville who were going to commute up to our office, and our other couple other co-founders all lived up in the Grass Valley, Nevada City area. So Auburn was like the perfect like halfway point to go. The Sacramento Roseville people can have a cross commute that goes against traffic, and it all works out very nicely. You know, I would say 2020 really like neutralized that, and not in completely positive ways, right? Like I think that there's a lot about having an office and a collaborative culture and being able to like be face to face that is challenging in the new world that we live in. But the new world that we live in, I mean, 65% of our workforce is permanent work from home.
Oh,
I don't have to love it, but it's the reality. And, you know, I have a bunch of great people who are, you know, we have been paying them pretty competitively and pretty well, but I have the Facebooks and the Googles and the Airbnbs coming up and going, I'll pay you more in dollars today.
Oh.
Okay. And you can just sit there and work from home. So you tell me if I'm going to be successful ordering everybody back to the office.
Oh,
we decided that we had to create some optionality for that. And it benefited us in a couple of ways. First of all, you know, we can't really compete with a Facebook on salaries day in and day out. We can't do it. Like every, you know, Facebook, earns more revenue per ounce of engineering effort than we ever will. It's just, it's just the way it works. Okay. So, effectively we compete on culture. Now, mind you, I want to be really clear. Like we pay well and we pay to bring in some of the best and brightest talent, but you know, I could make more money going to work for Facebook as a VP.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I have to tell many of our VPs, you could probably make more money and get a job at Facebook as a manager. Okay. But if you want to actually see the impact of your work, there's more to life than just what your W-2 says, right?
Thank you.
If you want to live and work in a culture that is incredibly great, that where you can see the impact of your work, where you can be a part of a team that is winning and making a difference in people's lives, then we are the place for you, and that's how we compete. We can't do that by paying people poorly on their W-2s, but we can pay fairly and be in the realm of market, but we're not going to have every last dollar that Facebook does. We never will.
Happiness has a value, right? And pride and these kind of things.
Yes.
Okay, so I can see why Auburn. I can see how the dynamics have changed.
Like now it's not just Auburn, right?
Yeah.
I joke that we're like, we used to be Auburn and Atlanta, and then we started a talent center in Philadelphia, and we have like an office in Poland. We still have all of those things. And yet today we're kind of like 100 and, nearly 200 like decentralized tokens on the blockchain, mm-hmm. To some extent.
Yeah.
So we have to be very intentional about driving communication, about working together as a team. It just takes a lot more work in some places. We have 35% of our team that is coming into an office Monday, Wednesday, Friday. And then we have about 10% of our team that's in the office 5 days a week.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, I'm going to switch gears a little bit and talk about your product at some level, but maybe on the broad spectrum. So your business, you work with wealth managers and people like that to help them with their clients to make better decisions on their investing.
Yep.
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, it starts, our mission as a company, we articulated, is empowering the world to invest fearlessly. So we actually start somewhat counterintuitively, not with a focus on our customers, but on our customers' customers.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because the problem that we were put on earth to solve is trying to remove fear and inject data into decision making. It's a skill set that turned out to be pretty valuable during a global pandemic, right?
I can only imagine.
And
yes.
So, like, what? In other words, for a lot of people, investing has been a little bit of a black box. I put money into it. I'm not sure why I win or why I lose, but, like, you know, I just kind of get a result later, and I'm not sure why. And we really help financial advisors tell the story of why and how risk works, and that risk and reward go hand in hand, and that you have to manage how much risk you're willing to take on in the portfolio and make sure that that's aligned to who you are as a person, or you will end up with too much risk. And then when something like the 2020 pandemic crash hits, you will panic, you will sell at the worst possible time, and you'll completely blow up your financial future. So, you know, what we do is we help financial advisors build a short-term framework to help their clients understand and react to risk appropriately, because that is how you transform a fearful investor who makes bad short-term decisions into that fearless investor who makes great short-term decisions. And great short-term decisions are the foundation that an amazing financial advisor uses to deliver that long-term financial outcome.
And don't take any of this as advice for you if you're out there listening, but I think it's fair to say that we're all seeing an escalation in how fast things are changing, and technology and COVID. Yes. It's made things like, it's almost like dog years, right? Things happen seven times as fast practically.
Totally.
Yeah. But so, and I see this, I watch a CNBC, I do investments, you know, we have the growth factory, as you know, I do angel investing.
Yep.
But it seems to me, and maybe you can back this up off of, you know, your customers, perceptions, but it seems to me that people are speculating a lot more. You look at all the meme stocks,
right,
and Bitcoin and all the different cryptocurrencies and NFTs and all this stuff that is almost seems like it shouldn't have the value that it does, but people are just betting on it, right? Even there's a lot more people that seem to be wanting to just kind of take risk.
Right. I think there's a few different factors that I do think it's a very interesting phenomenon. And I would tell you that it's almost like a controversial phenomenon in advisor circles. And I take a little bit of a contrarian view to that and just go, I think this is great. Like, I think it's great that we have more people, getting used to the idea of taking risks with their money to earn a return, because those are the future clients of the financial advisors that we serve. So I think that they should look at that as a really positive thing. But you have to break it down a couple of different ways. Number one, I would argue that you're right. We did like 10 years of innovation on how the world works in like 4 months in 2020.
Yeah.
You know, like we just like massively accelerated a bunch of things. And the whole meme stocks thing, you can look at that and you can go, this is stupid. But at what is really happening there is that people are taking what are relatively nominal amounts of money for them, and they're deciding to kind of pool their capital towards a cause or an idea or a thought. And just the virtue of like doing that, I think will lead people to make really interesting and positive decisions with where they're putting their capital in the future. Okay. So I let's not get too hung up on the fact that AMC theaters or GameStop may not have been the best investment, and that, you know, like we are training people to understand the idea of getting engaged in the markets and like taking risk in the markets. That was the biggest problem we had 10 years ago is, quote unquote, millennials got burned by 2008 and they don't want to invest. They don't want to take any risk. Okay. Well, we flipped that on
its
head.
They're back. I mean, they're everywhere.
We flipped that on its head. The millennials and the zoomers are out there going, I'm opening Robinhood accounts and going, I am figuring this thing out.
Yes.
And, you know, that is again, I'm speaking to like my audience of financial advisors. That is a rising tide that lifts all boats, because at the end of the day, when, you know, financial advisors are not for everybody, but I will tell you, they're for a lot more people than have them today, because when things get very complicated, and man, does life start to get complicated as you move a little bit later into your career, taxes are getting more complicated. That's not going to change anytime soon. And, you know, and the ways to think about protecting your assets for your family, for your heirs, for your kids, that's getting more complicated. All these things are getting more complicated. When things are deeply complicated and really important, we want to have a human to like look at them for us and make sure that they're right.
A sounding board that has expertise in this area.
And a behavioral coach who's going to make sure that we don't make the wrong decision out of fear or euphoria. Both are emotions that can lead us to make bad decisions.
Yeah. Well, okay. So in terms of looking at one's risk, with some of these, if you were to look at somebody's portfolio, would you rank things like, does your product rank things like, I don't know, let's call it early stage investing, like the startup investing, yep. the type of stuff I do.
Yep.
And like you got some stocks and you got some real estate and you got some money in the bank and you got some bonds and yep. you got maybe some crypto. So you got this wide variety. How do you, it's more risky to have the money in the bank for a lot of us, right? Because, you know, we're
Fair
seeing
point.
Inflation
risk
and stuff.
Is
so
a
it's
real
like,
risk.
Yeah.
That's right.
So you look at the money in the bank, is that risk or is that low risk or high risk?
Well, there's different kinds of ways to think about it. When we're thinking about just the risk of a portfolio, we're primarily looking at kind of like downside risk, upside, you know, like downside, okay. upside of the portfolio. So cash is going to be the lowest risk investment there.
Okay,
now,
yes.
when you flip into thinking about it with the element of time, you're absolutely going to be looking at inflation as a factor and going, if I don't get enough return, that's a risk.
So is gold risky or is it low risk?
I don't know the risk number of GLD off the top of my head.
Yeah, but it's on the lower side.
It's probably on the lower side.
Okay.
But I would tell you, like, so our risk number is 1 to 99. We kind of invented this scale back in 2011. And, you know, the market, the S&P 500 index, will range somewhere between a 74 and an 82, you know, depending on kind of how things are trending. The risk number was coming down for the S&P 500, and the pandemic just pushed it right back up because it put more volatile data into the model, right?
Okay. What about a piece of real estate? Do you put something like that into the model, or is that excluded?
You can. Now I would say that, like, look, we're primarily focused on helping financial advisors measure risk in investment portfolios that they're managing,
not the totality of.
But many of them want to do the totality, and so we've facilitated that. But what is really automated in the product is where we've got a data feed coming in that says what you own from the custodian where those assets are held,
right.
And a data feed coming in that tells us the return volatility and correlations of the assets that you own. That's all the stocks, all the different, we cover about 500,000 different securities products and strategies that we have data coming into the platform for. But for example, we just added cryptos. Do a lot of advisors allocate client money to crypto? No, but they've got clients that own it and they want to be able to analyze it. Okay. I have some advisors who are mad at us for putting crypto in the product. They're like, if rocks were correlated to the portfolio, would you analyze those? And I'm like, if the SEC declares them to be securities and we get a data feed, yes.
Okay.
Because we're not making a value judgment. In fact, wait a minute, rocks. Like, isn't that what gold is? It's a really valuable rock that is correlated or anti-correlated to the portfolio. So yes, we do that.
What about debt and stuff like options and things like that? Is that all correlated in there?
It can be. So options are a really complicated instrument. So we don't handle like throw some stock options in and they just recognize them. But it's very easy for an advisor to go in and plug in if they're doing like cover calls on some of the stock that clients own or things like that. Like, they can reflect that in there.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
And you can put private equity stuff in there.
Oh, you can.
It's not something where you're going to just search for a local company you've invested in and be able to find it, because there's no data feed for that. But you can plug in an angel investment and say, here's how I feel about the upside and downside of that investment.
Okay. You know? You could give it
Then it's going to weight it in. And then you can say, how do I want to think about correlating this, right?
Yeah.
Pick a proxy for that. So that's how we handle those.
Okay. So that's going to lead me into, because you brought up in a note that went back and forth between us, you said I could bring up the growth factory, which is my favorite thing to talk about.
Yeah.
Besides talking about winning, which you have been doing, but what we're working on is we're launching the growth factory accelerator and a venture fund.
Yeah.
So that's obviously a high risk type of companies. We're investing into 100 over 4 years, so it spreads the risk.
It does
somewhat,
spread the risk out, yes.
Or a lot, but it's still a very risky asset class.
Sure. Yep.
So, but that asset class,
but
venture.
Mark, I've got the Risk 99 license plate on my car.
You do?
Right? I do. So, I'm very excited to be an investor in growth.
I appreciate you helping and being
for
involved.
Sure.
It's kind of a thing where you want to have leaders, or we want to have leaders of the region, of the Sacramento region, rally around this, because these startups, they're our future, right?
Yep.
They're gonna, as companies like you, like Riskalyze, blow up and are successful and hire hundreds of employees and create all this opportunity and all this wealth for a lot of people, a lot of great jobs. You know, we want that for more people, right?
That's
and
right.
So we sit in a world where venture capital as an asset class is blowing up, and it needs to find its way here to Sacramento, and we need more investable startups, maybe more back, like when you started,
it's
you were able to get
an egg problem, right?
It is.
And so that's what I love about what you're doing with this, is that we're creating the environment for those startups to get funded and succeed, which is creating the ecosystem of startups to invest in. And you've got to have both. And it's a chicken and egg problem. So you just have to, you just have to keep working at building that network. And I think, man, what a great head start we have because of what you're doing here.
I think it's a great head start. I look at it as success breeds success,
yep.
Right? So if Aaron Klein succeeds, what happens? And people around you listening to this podcast, they get just a little bit more confidence. Mm-hmm. Hey, if Aaron can do it,
anybody can do it. That's probably
even Aaron.
Yeah.
Holy cow.
But in all seriousness, I think that's true. And you mentioned it a moment ago. There's also, what I think is really, really cool is, for a while we've been able to watch like our employee base, you might say inject capital into the real estate market locally, mm-hmm. right? Into car dealerships locally and things like that. Okay. So this kind of event creates the opportunity for at least some of those people, particularly the ones who joined really early, to start injecting their capital into investing in that way. Right.
Yeah.
And to me, that's exciting. That's really exciting. And that is what is going to create more of that ecosystem. And then some of those people, hopefully not the key ones that we need for the next decade of this journey, but some of those people are going to be leave and be entrepreneurs themselves.
Yes.
Right. And I'm going to hopefully get first dibs to invest in their companies as well.
Well,
right?
Introduce them to Growth Factory. We may want to bet on them as well if they're
absolutely.
Local.
There you go.
That's what it's all about. I think, again, success breeds success. Yep. It happens with our teammates. It happens with our family members. You're a family man.
Yep.
Your family sees you succeeding, your kids, and they're starting to go like, wow, it's inspiring. Sometimes it's probably tough living in dad's footsteps.
I hope it means that my boys will pay a little bit more attention in math class or something like that. We'll see if that works.
I love it.
And my daughter too.
Okay. So just as we start thinking about the next person in line, how do we win? How do you win as an individual? I want to maybe go through kind of quickly and maybe get some life hacks from you.
Okay,
you've obviously been successful. What do you do? Well, maybe we'll start like a day in the life of somebody who's a driven, successful person. What's that look like?
Yeah.
A day in the life of a real business person.
Okay. So, I mean, I would caveat this by saying that like people are individuals, right? And everybody's different and how people operate. So like, I can tell you what mine looks like, but it's probably going to be different from other people. I remember reading, for example, that like Jeff Bezos gets up at like, something like 8 o'clock and like putters around for a couple of hours and won't take his first meeting until 10. That is the exact opposite of my schedule,
okay.
Right? But it's, like different people. And then you have people who, they're like, they got like Tim Cook at Apple gets up at 3:30 in the morning. And I'm just like, I've never been able to get myself to do that. So like people are individuals, but look, a couple of things that I would say, I think you have to figure out like what you value and what you care about, and then try to, kind of organize your life and your routines and your work around that. For me, I was a night owl. I was a total night owl, and that just did not work well as my family got bigger. First of all, my wife needs some time, like she's a quality time person. And so, that means that like, you can't get away with like doing a quick 30 minutes here or something like that. Like she's a quality time person. She needs that time. My kids.
She sounds pretty demanding.
in a very good way. But like we've been married for 20 years and you just learn that about your partner, right? Like what do they need?
My wife doesn't even want me around anymore. We've been married a little longer. So.
That's what she needs. And, my kids, during this, I've been doing this a decade. My kids are now 17, 14, and 12. So the 17-year-old is the one we adopted about five and a half years ago. And so, if you think about it, when we started, they were 4 and 2, right?
Yeah.
So, intense time. And so I had to kind of organize around that. And one of the things I realized was that I was going to have to not be a night owl. Mm-hmm. I was just going to have to turn it around and like figure out a way to be more disciplined about that. So I go to bed at 10:30 and I get up at 4:45. That's what I do. And I've got to have a little bit of time to read and just just like spend some time thinking and reading. I literally have used, just to give myself a little bit more self-control, Apple's screen time controls to keep the email notifications off and the Slack notifications off and the social media off until 6:30 in the morning. That's what I try to do.
Okay. So you found a way to use technology to keep you off technology.
Keep me off technology. Exactly right. So I really need that time to, my Kindle app works, during that time. I'll read, I'll spend some time there, and then I will work out in the morning, and then 6:30 is hit, and it's a sprint from 6:30 to 6 o'clock at night, and that's
okay.
What it is.
Okay, so you read. So what are you reading now, and what would you, maybe for an entrepreneur, what would you suggest they consider reading?
So first of all, my faith has been a big part of my life for a long time. So I always start by reading the Bible, and I read things that affect my spiritual life as well. I usually am reading business type books. Now, when I say business type books, it's not always about that. Sometimes it's about learning about new things and just stretching your mind in different ways. I just read Michael Dell's autobiography, which is super interesting.
Is that an older one?
It just came out.
Oh, just came out. Oh,
just
okay.
Came out.
Because I read a book 20 years ago from Dell.
He did read a book 20 years ago, and he actually, I haven't read that book, but he makes a veiled apology in this book about being very guarded and not being very candid in that book, which I thought was interesting. So now it makes me want to go back and read it to understand.
Yeah, it's been so long since I read it, but I remember the one thing I took away, my takeaway from the original book, we used it in building our companies. He had no offices in the book. He said, no, I sit right out in the middle of everybody and no offices. Okay. And I'm like, okay, so that's how we converted over to our, be among the people a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway.
That's interesting.
So, so you're reading.
I read books like that. I read books about, there's a lot of knowledge. Now, one of my hacks for reading books is that I do not get hung up. If a book is bad, a lot of books, I just have to say this bluntly, are basically blog posts that they really wanted to charge $26.99 for. So they wrote a bunch of filler at the end. Mm-hmm. And the first chapter or two are what's interesting. So I've just trained myself to go, when a book starts getting really boring and repetitive, I'm just speed flipping through and almost speed reading the page a little bit, but really just oh, maybe that's interesting, and zipping back. But I'll just I'll speed through the end of a book and just go, I'm not reading the rest of that.
So one of my, I don't know if this is good or bad, I'll call it a hack. I wonder if maybe you do this. You said reading the Bible, which I'm not religious about reading the Bible, but I do like to read books over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Because I sort of immerse myself in them, and I feel like I need to come back to them because they resonate.
I do the same thing.
Oh, you do? Okay.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, one of those. So probably the one that I've read, I must have gone through this book, and I'll just dip back into it 5 or 6 times, is The Hard Thing About Hard Things by Ben Horowitz.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I read right when the pandemic hit, I listened to that one. I'm like, oh, man.
Oh, yeah. I felt like I was living parts of that book during the pandemic, right?
Yeah.
And so that will really put anything that you're facing in business in context.
I read that one. I listened to it on audiobook 3 or 4 times.
My favorite passage from that book is, there's always a move. You always have a move. When you're sitting there as a CEO and you're looking at a horrible fact pattern and you're looking at disaster in the face, there's always a move. And you just have to figure out what the move is. And that's exactly what I was thinking about in 2020, as we were figuring out how to get back to our path to growth.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. There's always a move. That's a takeaway out there, my friends.
That's right.
The hard thing about the hard thing. So we only have a few minutes left, but so you get up and work out every day.
Yeah.
So
get up and work out every day.
You feel like that helps with stress and things like that?
I think so. Yeah. I mean, there are some days that I work out at least 3 times a week.
Okay.
That's my commitment to myself. And then, there's at least 1 day a week that I will literally leave the house at 6 to 6:30 just to get in early. Another big hack that I created during 2020, I had a little version of this before, but 2020, I formalized it. I have 1 day a week that is project day. I will not book meetings on that day. It is wide open.
But is it at your office?
It's at the office.
Okay,
I'm at the office. I'm at the office. So people can find me if they really need me, but I will not put meetings on the calendar. I just won't put meetings on the calendar. I might put a lunch because it's a good day to meet a friend for lunch or something like that.
Yeah.
It's not an easy day. It's one of the most intense days of my week, but I am working on the things that I think are the most important in the business that day.
One day per week.
I'm just like,
what day of the week is it?
Normally Tuesdays.
Okay.
It'll flip around if I have something that's critical on a Tuesday that week.
One day, you know, they'll block a day.
It's called project time. And I'm booked solid, and it is not an easy day, to be clear. Like, people think, oh, you basically work 4 days a week. No, like that day, I probably get 2 days worth of work done because it's like the most critical things, you know, that I need to get done and spend time with. And I am, you know, oftentimes pinging people and going, hey, I really could use to talk to you about this. I'm working on this today. Do you have a few minutes? They're like, I have a few minutes at 20. I'm like, great. Ping me when you're ready. And then I'm working on it a bit more. And then like we jump on and do an impromptu call. So it's not like I'm not talking to people that day, but I'm not booked back to back to back with meetings. And then I don't have time to think and work on the critical things that we've got to accomplish for the
business. You have an assistant or somebody that sort of helps you to keep you from having to, I don't know.
So I have an executive assistant who manages logistics and calendar and meetings and agendas for those meetings. And, you know, I would say we're still fine tuning some of that, but she does a really, you know, good job of that. And then I have a chief of staff.
Okay.
And the chief of staff is really kind of an executive level role in our company, but rather than really having a lot of functions report into that role, that job is like really stitching together the leadership team and getting, you know, initiatives that go across teams to like flow together and work and make sure things don't fall through the cracks.
When did you get the decide to do an executive assistant? And then when did you decide to do the chief of staff? How many employees did you have at that time?
So my first executive assistant was actually employee number 4. Huh. But to be very clear, she did the jobs of about 85 people in the company today. Mm. So she was customer service.
Yeah.
She was, you know, a lot of the accounting function. She was a lot of this, a lot of that. I mean,
But she was still acted as an assistant to you because it allowed you to
but
work on bigger projects.
But she did very little of that logistics assistant stuff in all candor.
But a little bit, okay.
But a little bit of that.
So that was early on, 4 or 5 employees.
It was very early, 4 or 5 employees. And so she, by the way, then was one of my first chiefs of staff, okay? And now she is our senior vice president of operations.
Ooh,
like she runs like a big, like all of people ops, legal, you know, governance, risk, and compliance, everything like
sounds
reports
like a rock
into
star.
Her. She is a rock star.
Okay. And when did you first decide? Because I'm thinking out there, people listening going, okay, yeah, it must be nice. 200 employees, you got an assistant, 300 employees. But, you know, you can start down that path even under 10 employees. But what about the chief of staff role? That's kind of a unique position, I think,
is unique
for a small company.
And, yeah, and we didn't start that. I want to say the first time we did that was, 2015, 2016. Okay. We probably had 100.
And is that person like a drill sergeant or super good with people?
Very good with people.
Okay, because they need to have great follow-through, obviously.
It's about scale. It's about scale because that person can go to a meeting that is double scheduled with a meeting I'm in and kind of represent my interests.
It's not the hammer for you. Okay.
No, I mean, it can be. It sometimes is. That person will go in and say, listen, like we already had this discussion. We're not going to reopen this. Like Aaron said that, you know, we all agreed that it was going to be this way. And like, we need to commit to that. We need to push forward. And, you know, those people can go, I really want to have another conversation with Aaron. I've got more data to input a decision. And great. They'll schedule that meeting. But, you know, that's one of those things that sometimes it feels like it is the hammer probably to some of the other folks.
All right. So we only have a minute left. Okay. Let me let you just have closing thoughts. Anything else you want to say to our audience, to me, to Scott over here who's doing our audio visual? Let it rip. I'm about to pass it to you. You're the last word.
First of all, thank you for having me on. Again, this is my second opportunity to be on your show. And, you know, I feel an enormous sense of gratitude for, you know, gosh, the team I've had the chance to work with, the financial advisors that we are so deeply honored to serve that have kind of put us into this position. And so, man, I look at that success and just 100% say it's a team effort that has driven us here. And, you know, I guess I would just leave the audience, which I think is a lot, like a large percentage of the audience of this show are entrepreneurs who are very excited excited about the future. And I just want to say to them, like, it is harder work than you think, but it's also easier than you think. It's not as magical as you think to get there. It's really all about hard work. It's really all about being willing to, you know, have a vision for where you think a market should go, and find fit with that market, be flexible on some of those details, and then just don't give up. Like, the number one reason we're here is because we didn't quit. There were a lot of times we wanted to quit because it felt like we weren't going to get there, and we just refused to quit. And that's why we're here.
Refused to quit. And I love your mindset about gratitude for your teammates and the people that were alongside you on the way up. So, Aaron Klein, appreciate your friendship. Appreciate you coming and sharing your story on our show. Best of luck in scaling this thing.
Thank you.
You betcha. Welcome back to the Mark Haney Show. Aaron Klein, what a story. One thing we did not talk about with Aaron is that he recently joined the Entrepreneurs Organization, EO. It's an organization that has really helped so many entrepreneurs. And I was the president of the Entrepreneurs Organization for the last couple of years, and I have handed the baton off to another gentleman, Arik Levy. He's handling it now. And every few years, we sort of hand off the baton. But EO is a special organization. It's something I'm proud to be involved with. If you want information about EO, if you want information about how to escalate, if you want information on how to grow your business, you want to be a part of people that are really forward-leaning in the world of entrepreneurship, hit me up. I want to help you. And know that if you're out there fighting the good fight for our freedom, our security, and our way of life, or fighting the good fight for entrepreneurship, you know that we're never above you. We're never below you. We are always by your side.
Can you see by the dawn?
This segment includes the personal knowledge, experiences, and opinions about angel investing by seasoned angel investors. This content is for informational purposes only and should not be considered as legal, tax, investment, or financial advice. Nothing in the segment constitutes a solicitation, recommendation, or endorsement.